I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This last weekend in Iraq was the second bloodiest since the fall of Saddam in terms of Iraqi-on-Iraqi attacks. At least 70 civilians have been killed and almost 200 wounded after two car bombings and a gangland-style execution of election workers less than a mile from the coalition forces headquarters in Baghdad. President Bush, speaking at today's end-of-year press conference, insisted the attackers would not succeed in derailing upcoming elections.
I saw an interesting comment today by somebody, in the Karbal area or Najaf area. He said, look, what they're trying to do, they being the terrorists, are trying to create sectarian violence. He said they're not going to intimidate us from voting. People want to vote.
Joining us now from Baghdad is John Burns of the New York Times. John, tell us, first of all, how are Iraqis reacting to the weekend violence? They don't seem overly intimidated, given that thousands turned out for the funeral today of those killed in the Najaf bombing, which, in fact, took place at a funeral.
No, I'd have to say not. And I personally have not been in Najaf and Karbala today, but the extraordinary thing here is the degree to which normal life resumes in the wake of these things, even in the immediate area of these bombings.
What about the impact of some of these photographs that we're seeing on the elections? As brutal as the car bombs over the weekend were, the photographs that have really chilled people here are of the assassination of three election workers on their knees on the ground, guns held to their head, during what seemed to be, you know, rush hour. What is known about the killing of those election officials, and how is that impacting the upcoming election?
Well, I spoke with officials of the Iraqi Independent Election Commission today who are moving forward with the mechanics of this election. Nonetheless, in broad daylight, unmasked assailants executing people in the street in the heart of Baghdad, of course, sends a tremendous chill down people's spine. And what's very unclear, in fact, even Dr. Alawi, the interim prime minister who I met this afternoon, said there's a great deal that's unknown about this election. We really don't know much about the popular preferences. We don't know whether people are going to come out and vote. We know there are 14 million eligible voters. Will 2 million turn out? Probably a failure. Will 8 or 9 million turn out? Probably a significant success. Nobody really knows. All we can say for sure is that events like yesterday's are certainly not going to help.
What is known about the insurgency? Is their goal to undermine the election or to cause, as some have said, sectarian violence to turn Shia on Sunni?
I think both. But, you know, the main thing about this is that we really do not know. I think we can be sure that the bloodshed will continue and get worse and that they will try and stop the mechanics of it. They will try and kill the candidates, the officials. They will try and stop public rallies. They will probably bomb public rallies if any are held. And they will try and stir sectarian violence, Sunni on Shia, because the bottom line in all of this is that any election result that you can predict is going to evolve into a Shiite majority in the new Provisional National Assembly to be elected on January the 30th. And that is the nightmare of the Ba'athist diehard. That's what they want to prevent at all costs.
How far do you think the Sunni insurgents are willing to go? Do you fear a civil war?
Well, you know, we stop short a little bit, usually, in the way we write about this. It's talking about a civil war. That's a very dramatic outcome. That's absolutely the worst-case scenario. You can't preclude it. But there are upsides to this as well. If you see the mechanics of this election so far, you see the enthusiasm and the doubtiness and the perseverance of the people who have come forward. Now, remember, 7,700 candidates, several hundred political parties, groupings, alliances, and independent candidates in a country which never experienced this, never mind Saddam Hussein. Mm. This was a country which has never had an election like this before, and what we see is plenty of signs of a tremendous vibrancy here. People want these elections. If you could get the heart of the thinking behind this, it may well be, yes, there'll be bloodshed, yes, a lot of people won't show up. But what will people be saying after January the 30th? They will be saying the United States and its Iraqi partners attempted an exercise in the Middle East, never before attempted on this scale in any Arab country. They got probably several million people to turn out. Who knows, perhaps as many as 10 million people to turn out. And I think the view, the hard view at the core of this is that will be a triumph.
John Burns, Baghdad Bureau Chief for the New York Times. John, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's always a pleasure.
It's been called one of the premier American cultural monuments of the 20th century, and it's now cleared to pick up and move, a prospect that is exciting and enraging the art world. The art in question is a collection of some 800 paintings housed by the Barnes Foundation, amassed by pharmaceutical magnate Albert Barnes, and displayed in the quirky and restricted setting of his home in the suburbs of Philadelphia. Last week, a judge overrode Barnes' will and ruled it was legal for the foundation to move the collection to a more accessible site in downtown Philadelphia. Some art critics say that will send a chill through the donation-dependent museum world. We're going to speak to the Barnes director in a moment. But first, also chilling, to many, is the $20 it'll cost to get into the newly reopened Museum of Modern Art in New York, and the return of the blockbuster King Tut exhibit, this time privatized. Joining us first from New York with an overview of the nation's museums, Jason Kaufman, chief U.S. correspondent for the Art newspaper. Hello.
Thank you very much.
And Jason, your thoughts on moving the beautiful paintings from the glorious and quirky Barnes Foundation in suburban Philadelphia to Museum Mile in the city. Why is this such a hot topic? One critic we read agrees with the move. Roberta Smith writes in the New York Times, it's become a monument to an oppressive vision that is frozen in time. But Christopher Knight writes a scathing critique of the planned move. He says, it'll become the Penn Station of our generation. When the original Barnes Museum is gone and the art moved to the city, we'll regret it as we did the loss of the old, beautiful Penn. Why is this so controversial?
Well, I don't know if it's good for art. I know it's good for Philadelphia. Many people are accustomed to seeing art, great art, such as that that's in the Barnes collection, in museums that seem increasingly standardized today. Whereas the Barnes, perhaps owing to Mr. Barnes's idiosyncrasies, was a rather unique experience. It was unique in the sense that it was in a very quiet setting. Because of the restrictions on visitors, one was never crowded by others in the galleries. It fostered a very intimate and contemplative experience of art that was very moving for many people. I visited with people whom I brought for the first time, who left and literally were in tears because of the power of that experience. If that situation is changed by moving the collection downtown to some kind of building, inevitably it's going to be more like other museums, and it's going to have much higher attendance. There are going to be crowds in the galleries, and the uniqueness of the experience is going to be lost.
So this debate does continue, and as we said, we'll speak to the director of the Barnes in a moment. But there's other big news in the museum world, and you've told us that the big trend in museums is moving a lot of people through a collection. And that was started by the first King Tut visit. Now Tut returns, and it's expected again to draw big crowds. What are concerns, if any, with the Tut exhibit?
Yeah, I think that the King Tut exhibit ties in with a number of other exhibits in the museum world that seem to be motivated as much by money as anything else. And when the money becomes the primary motivator in mounting exhibitions, it always raises a red flag because one wants the curatorial decisions, one wants the scholarship to take priority. And there have been a number of groups that have been getting into the for-profit museum exhibition business. And it's not always clear that they're going to maintain the standards that are upheld by the profession.
Yeah, the Tut traveling exhibit is taking place to raise money for the Egyptian government. It's being run by a private company which runs the Staples Center in Los Angeles. And the Met in New York refused to take the exhibit because of the high ticket price, $30.
Yeah, one of the reasons that the Met declined is because of a policy upheld by the director, Felipe de Montebello. He believes that it is inappropriate for a museum to charge for special exhibitions. The thinking is that once a museum begins to charge for special exhibitions, it may begin to adjust its exhibition program in order to balance the books. And when that happens, there can be all kinds of wrong moves in decision-making about what to show, moves that will have more to do with the bottom line than with the actual mission of the museum, which is not to make money, but which is to educate the public and to maintain its collections.
The Museum of Fine Arts here in Boston has been criticized by some for that, for putting in exhibits of guitars, for example, to draw the huge crowds. But how are museums faring financially, and can they afford not to do that?
Well, I think that many museums across the country suffer the decline in their endowments owing to the fall-off in the economy, and suffered also a decline in their visitorship after 9/11. And I know that many museums did curtail their programs somewhat, but many of them also were bolstered by the booming economy in the 90s and have a lot of money and had already begun expansion programs that, after a sort of false step in the last few years, have resumed and are going full speed ahead. So that now I think one could say that the majority of the museums in the country, virtually every major institution, is either undergoing an expansion now or has recently completed one or is planning one.
Well, in fact, let's talk about a couple. The Museum of Modern Art reopens after its huge renovation. Overall, the verdict?
It's a remarkable building. It is a tremendous showcase for the greatest collection of modern art in the world. If one has any quibbles about it, I suppose it might have to do with the enormity of the building. I mean, these are vast spaces. They have more of a kind of institutional feel than a domestic one. The same thing that was lost with the Barnes collection moving. But nonetheless, I think that it's really a model for reserve, especially because it's not a building that, as some museums have chosen to do, is one that will simply call attention to itself. Instead, it's a building that steps back and allows the art to take priority in the experience.
Hmm. How do you feel overall about American museums? Do you have a positive sense of where they are?
I absolutely do. I think that the museums in the United States are among the greatest in the world, and they're also supported rather uniquely in the world by the population itself, owing to the very enlightened tax law that we have that allows people across the country to support institutions and to take a tax benefit. Mm-hmm. So I have a very strong sense that the museums in the country are adapted to the needs of the population and are very well supported by patrons in the country, and that in general, they tend to police themselves and to make just decisions that are for the best of the country.
Jason Kaufman, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much.
And when we come back, what to do when museum buildings become as precious as the works they house? We'll speak with the executive director of the Barnes Foundation as she prepares to move the foundation's precious art collection, and also with the director of another quirky personal legacy museum, the Isabella Stewart Gardner, here in Boston. They're planning to expand. Stay tuned. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing our conversation about the future of American museums and the prickly questions such as whether a collector's wishes should be, can be, preserved in perpetuity. We turn now to two museum directors who've wrestled with that question. Kimberly Camp is executive director and CEO of the Barnes Foundation in Lower Merion Township, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Kimberly.
Hi, how are you?
I'm just fine. Ann Hawley, director of the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, named after the famously eccentric collector who opened her faux Venetian palace to the public as a museum in 1903. Welcome, Anne.
Thank you.
And Kimberly, I want to go to you first because I have a feeling you're probably itching to talk. You just heard art critic Jason Kaufman say that he feels that the move of the Barnes Foundation from the suburbs to the city is not a good idea. Why are you doing this?
I think that, you know, the one point I want to make first is that there's probably no statement other than him saying the name that was accurate. Dr. Barnes created the Barnes Foundation as a school. It's not a museum. In our filings with the court about the move, we said from the beginning and continue to emphasize the fact that we are remaining a school. We're not changing it into a museum. The ensembles will remain the same. The room relationships will remain the same to each other. And the move is really predicated on our research of Barnes' archival material that talks about how he felt this was a living, breathing school that should promote the advancement of education, democracy in education and be dynamic to be able to change as society changes.
Well, but as you know, Barnes said that his home was the only sane place for the display of art in America. He rejected a relationship with the city because he thought that came with all sorts of strings attached. So
that's actually not true. He talks explicitly about making the collection more available to the public after his death.
And you feel that that's what this will do?
It most definitely will do that. A lot of people don't realize that restrictions on visitation are not imposed by Albert Barnes. That was something that even with the New York Times saying it, they had to print a correction. The limitations are imposed on us by the local neighborhood, by the Lower Merion Township. Mm. The Barnes is limited to 1,200 people per week. So will
it change the experience of the visitor to the Barnes if it's moved and suddenly there are many more people? It was such an intimate, it is such an intimate experience right now.
Our legal documents and the petition have said that the gallery size will remain the same. The ensembles remain the same. We will only allow in 100 people at a time because we have committed to maintaining the Barnes experience. So a lot of the criticism has been of people who, as I've often said, never let the facts get in the way of a good opinion.
Well, Anne Hawley, I want to bring you in. Anne Hawley's director of the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum here in Boston. What do you think about what your colleagues are doing at the Barnes?
Well, I think that Kimberly has wrestled with a ferocious problem, and I think that this is the only real solution since the community was unwilling to let the Barnes serve the public in the way they wished. And I think the big challenge for the Barnes now is to do what Kimberly's talking about in terms of this reinstallation. And I think that having won this incredible legal victory to preserve the institution, now getting it right, which is what we all face when we build buildings, is going to be your next lion, Kimberly.
Well, Kimberly, what were the financial problems of the Barnes? Because obviously this wasn't on a whim.
No, it certainly wasn't. I came here 6 years ago, and the foundation had gone through battle after battle. And so in 50 years after Barnes' death, the endowment had grown from $10 million to $10 million. Mm. We were told by the Lower Merion Township we were not zoned for fundraising, so they wouldn't allow us to have events. With that and no endowment, the organization, with 1,200 people a week, not being able to be open on weekends in July and August, not only could we not generate additional earned income, but many foundations and individuals just felt that there seemed no way out of this situation.
Anne Hawley, I'm wondering if you sympathize with those of you who run these small jewels of museums who have to struggle with restrictions that were laid out and mandates that were laid out, and trying to follow those but also guide the museum into the future.
Well, it's a big challenge, but it can be done. The thing that's so crucial is generating an endowment, which is what Kimberly's talking about. You've got to have an endowment to cover at least half of your expenses because you can't raise the kind of money through big corporate events or large admissions revenues because you've got to keep the experience small.
Well, but you've just unveiled these plans to build an administrative and merchandising wing to the museum. You're not moving as the Barnes is, but isn't this against the spirit of what, you know, Mrs. Jack, as she's known,
might have
wanted?
Her mandate was that the museum should be for the education and enjoyment of the public forever. That was the overall mandate. We're doing the new building in order to preserve the collection because we don't have any real place to check coats. We shouldn't have a cafe in what was formerly a gallery of the museum.
I've thought about that.
Yes.
People trotting around with food in the same, you know, in the same area. It's another example of how of a place where people love the building as much as they love the artwork that's in the building.
You know, I just was in London last week, and I was at the British Museum, which has put the Foster Dome, you know, over one of its courts. And in that court sits the old British Library, which was for several centuries the place where so many important works of the English culture were produced, and they have now taken that library, which no longer really has a function there, and they've put it in the center of the courtyard, and you can go look at it, but the books aren't there anymore. It's just the room, and it has this terrible death feeling about it, and I think that's the challenge in trying to keep you can't really put something in aspect if it's not a living, working place, then you can't just keep the shell of it. And so I think that's the challenge all of us face when we're taking institutions that have been created by a very visionary founder with certain restrictions and making them live for today.
Well, we wish you well, both of you, in that challenge, because they are jewels and appreciated by so many people. And thank you for talking to us about them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ann Hawley, director of the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. Kimberly Camp, executive director and CEO of the Barnes Foundation in Lower Merion Township, Pennsylvania. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A notorious serial killer thought to have murdered 8 people in Wichita, Kansas in the 70s and 80s before disappearing is once again leaving his calling card. The BTK, or Bind, Torture, Kill serial killer, left an alleged victim's driver's license and photo in a Wichita park last week. BTK initially resurfaced in March when he sent clues about his past crimes to a Wichita newspaper. Joining us to talk about the case is Robert Beatty, a lawyer who's writing a book about BTK. And Robert, can you start by telling us the kind of information he is sending police?
He is apparently sending his own autobiography in a book he calls the BTK Files. He sent a list of chapter titles in May, and he's apparently sent 3 of those chapters. One of them was apparently included on December 14th in a package that was found in the park along with the driver's license.
The information indicates the year he was born, 1939, that his father was killed in World War II, that he went to Sunday school?
Well, that's what he writes about himself. The police have been looking for somebody matching. It's actually a very long description. We wouldn't have time to go into everything, but the police seem to believe that this is true. He would be about 65 years old, had military background in the 60s, technical training, and worked as a photocopy machine repairman.
Right, and loved trains. Well, how do police know that this is credible?
Well, this has been an almost 31-year investigation, and all of the information that he's provided in his communications is consistent with the other information they have independently developed and that the FBI profilers believe.
It's raising so many questions, though. I read one, for instance. He recently left this driver's license of an alleged victim, just left it in a park, and one of the policemen was quoted as saying, gosh, if you treasured something for 20-odd years, why would you just leave it in a park? It could have been thrown away.
The speculation that I hear is most common is he wants these items found, but he doesn't want them found in his possession. It's a very strange psychology that nobody can really figure this guy out. The psychologists I've spoken with say he just does not fit the mold of what they've come to expect from these serial killers.
And police are also saying that they feel that BTK has not killed since 1986. Is there a sense of why he wouldn't?
The psychologists I've spoken with say that just people, as they age, they're usually not as violent.
Well, and back in the 70s and 80s, women were afraid to enter their homes alone. He would cut phone lines, so women were constantly checking their phone lines. Some still do from that time. But has that kind of hysteria returned now that the sense is that he is alive?
There was a spike back in the spring when this story first broke, and it's died off. there is still caution and anxiety, but there's not the same level of fear.
Robert Beatty, a Wichita lawyer who's also writing a book about the serial killer BTK. Robert, thanks for taking some time with us.
Thank you, Robin.
For most retailers, the holiday shopping season determines whether the entire year turns out to be a hit or a miss. And going into this past weekend, consumers seem to be holding onto their wallets. Well, analysts are watching closely to see if shoppers are just holding out for last-minute bargains or if they're really tightening the purse strings. Financial reporter Mark Mills joins us now with a consumer check-in. And Mark, boy, holding onto their purse strings, these analysts could not have been in the same Best Buy that I was in where there were lines and the cars in the parking lot. But, you know, overall, how are retailers doing?
Overall, it's turning out to be somewhat disappointing. It's not a lump of coal kind of holiday season for them, but it's not a blockbuster season either.
But we're hearing that last week the National Retail Federation estimated that 37.5 million people, mostly men, had not done their shopping yet. So was it hoped that they would come out this weekend?
Well, yes. A lot of retailers were counting on just a dynamite weekend this past weekend, thinking that a lot of people were holding off, procrastinating for one reason or another, perhaps hoping that stores would discount things to draw people in. There's almost a game of chicken that goes on now with consumers and retailers. Consumers holding back, saying, wait a minute, you got to cut those prices some more before I come in. And the retailer's mm-hmm. saying, well, we're going to hold off on that because when we cut our prices, we cut our profit margins, and that hurts our business. I think the retailers are blinking now, and they're going to have to discount things because they need to empty those shelves and get people in there to do some buying.
Do we have any Monday morning quarterbacking? Do we have some reports?
Well, the final figures for the weekend are not in yet, but the initial reports that have come in are for somewhat of a disappointing weekend, considering mm-hmm. it was the last weekend before right. Christmas, which is next Saturday.
Well, and last year, consumers had the tax rebates. They had the extra cash from that huge bulge of refinancing mortgages. So is that not evident this year?
Well, those things really are not around this year. And, of course, when they do these year-over-year comparisons, you're comparing how the shopping goes this year to last year. And as you say, last year, a lot of people were flush with cash with those refunds and the refinancings. Also this year, Robin, the high energy costs are really cutting into middle America, lower income families. As they pay more to fill their cars and their gas tanks and heat their homes, they're going to have less to spend at the mall. So discounters such as Walmart mm-hmm. are seeing more disappointing sales. Some of the high-end retailers that cater to affluent America are seeing double-digit growth. Some of them are having a great holiday season.
Well, and what kind of changes are we seeing in the ways that people shop? I'm thinking gift cards.
Yeah, that has been a big change. Now, the gift cards have been around for a while, but more stores are offering them and more stores are pushing them. You're seeing actual ads on television and radio promoting getting gift cards as a gift. And it sort of complicates the numbers if you do these comparisons because the gift cards aren't counted as sales until they are actually cashed in and people buy something. Mm-hmm. So if there's, you know, tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars in gift cards being given, we won't necessarily know until people go in there and start buying things with those cards, maybe in the next couple of weeks.
Right. It may be even bigger then. Well, and so is there still a chance that this could turn out to be a winning year?
Well, it better happen pretty soon. I mean, the procrastinators better get to the mall. And, of course, we have snow in much of the Northeast today, which will discourage some shopping. I think there'll be a tremendous turnout on Friday. Many people will have the day before Christmas off. And let's face it, if you're a last-minute shopper, that's about the last minute. You're running out of time at that point. So Friday will be a big day. And then, of course, the week after Christmas is going to be critical with all of those gift cards. And people that go in and exchange merchandise, Robin, often will spend a little more on themselves and buy additional items because there are things on sale. And so that also is a very important part of determining whether the overall season is a good one.
Well, finally, before we let you go, what are the trends that you're seeing? Early on in the season, that was another complaint from retailers, that there wasn't one item that was jumping out, you know, the cabbage patch or whatever it was that was bringing people in. So in the seconds we have, what's selling?
All right, well, the iPod, of course, those music devices are selling well. PlayStation 2 game consoles. For girls, there's an item called Dora's Talking House, which is a little Latina doll that has a talking house that speaks bilingually and plays music, and that is very hot. And boys really want the radio-controlled Terrain Twister, and it's a little radio-operated thing that can go over mountains and water and snow and ice and everything, and it's a great little toy to play with. It's hard to get right now.
Don't I know it? Not that I'm revealing anything to a young boy in Pennsylvania.
Oh.
Mark Mills, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Financial reporter Mark Mills joining us in the studio. still to come. For the jazz lover in your life, our jazz critic James Isaac suggests a few things that might work just fine under the tree. You're listening to Here and Now. Time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. Many of you wrote, after our look at the renewed abortion debate and an admitted move in Congress by pro-life legislators to chip away at Roe v. Wade, we spoke with pro-choice Senator Barbara Boxer and pro-life Congressman Christopher Smith. Anna Brown of Wilmington, Delaware, thought I was too easy on Senator Boxer, who expressed concern that overturning Roe v. Wade would mean going back to the days when women died from illegal abortions. Anna writes, how many women died a year before Roe v. Wade? Dr. Bernard Nathanson, co-founder of NARAL, the National Association for the Repeal of Abortion Laws, has since admitted the actual number of women dying in abortions was very low. Well, Anna, you are correct. Dr. Nathanson did convert from pro-choice to pro-life and has said that he and other early NARAL members inflated numbers of deaths from abortion. According to the independent Guttmacher Institute, thousands of women died from botched illegal abortions in the 30s and 40s. But by 1973, the year Roe v. Wade was enacted, those numbers had dropped significantly, largely due to the fact that 17 states had already legalized abortions and doctors were performing them. We also spoke last week with Diane Zander, who made the documentary Girl Wrestler about a 13-year-old girl barred by Texas laws from the boys' wrestling team. Michael Benfield of Charlotte, North Carolina writes, some say a girl wrestling boys is a problem because of sexual excitement. Ms. Zander said that notion is irrelevant because wrestling isn't about sex. Well, speaking as a former teenage boy, I can assure you that the vast majority of teenage males would become sexually excited while wrestling a girl, which would inevitably change the nature of what they were doing. This is not sexism, it's biology. But we also heard from Deandra Zuniga. She writes, I am a 14-year-old freshman at Cesar Chavez High School in Delano, California. I am on the school wrestling team, and I wrestle against nothing but guys. Everyone's okay with it, including all the guys I wrestle against. By the way, I'm wrestling in the 160s weight class. After our piece on choral conductor Alan Lanham, who's in his 53rd and last year as full-time conductor of the Masterworks Chorale in Massachusetts, John Curie, a Massachusetts native living in Jacksonville, North Carolina, wrote, I had the good fortune to sing under Mr. Lanham in the Mass All-State High School Chorus in 1964. I remember thinking that he was an awfully hard taskmaster, but later saw that he produced an amazing sound from a rowdy bunch of high school students. Thanks again for a driveway moment, actually a Hardee's parking lot moment, but you get the idea, one of many that you have provided. Well, many of you also wrote, after we talked with the owner of Magnet America, which makes those yellow car ribbons supporting American troops, he's losing business to Chinese merchants who make and sell the ribbon for far less. Which reminded Tim Lucas, a former U.S. sailor, of marching in a 4th of July parade in Everett, Washington, handing out flags to kids along the way.
And as it turns out, all the flags that we were handing out said in great big letters across the bottom, Made in China. I was embarrassed. Here I am showing the flag on our greatest holiday, and it's not even a patriotic symbol. Why? Because it's made in China.
Finally, as part of our report on the Boston Ballet's Nutcracker, Mikko Nessonen, the company's artistic director, said that with new competition from the New York City Rockettes, the Nutcracker was no longer the only holiday show in town. Well, that prompted this phone call from Martha.
I want you to know that Black Nativity has been in production for the last 35 years, and we have just as many loyal people coming to our performance as the Nutcracker has.
Right, you are, Martha, and here's some music from the production of Langston Hughes' Black Nativity, a longtime Boston holiday tradition.
Oh,
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Miss Shepherd's kept their watch.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and I'm not even going to tell you how many days till Christmas because everyone else is. I will say that if you've got a jazz fan in your life, Here and Now's jazz aficionado James Isaacs is here with some choice gift recommendations. Welcome back, James.
Hello again, Robin.
Let's get right to it. What's number one?
Number one is a 4-CD boxed set, The Contemporary Record Story. It's a wonderful package. Contemporary Records, based, by the way, at 8481 Melrose Place. That's true, in Los Angeles.
Like the show.
Yeah.
Okay.
Was begun in 1951 by a very interesting guy. His name was Lester Koenig, and this is, in part, the fruit of his labor. It really is an excellent survey course of what Lester Koenig did.
Well, who's on the label? Who do you get to hear on the set?
Well, a lot of people would automatically consider Contemporary Records to be a, in quotation marks here, West Coast jazz or cool jazz label. It was much more than that. Lester Koenig had eclectic taste. On the first of the four discs, though, they pretty much concentrate on his West Coast jazz stars, people like Howard Rumsey's Lighthouse All-Stars, saxophonist and flutist Buddy Collette. We're going to hear a track, though, from 1956 by a guy who did his very best work for Contemporary, Art Pepper, alto saxophonist, and here he is paired with tenor player Warren Marsh. One of the hallmarks of West Coast or cool jazz was soft-toned, interweaving, I guess you'd call it, counterpoint. And here it is on the standard tune, All the Things You Are.
Pretty Art Pepper and Warren Marsh playing All the Things You Are on the new compilation of music from the Contemporary Records label. And James Isaacs, I understand Sonny Rollins recorded for the label as well.
He did. Sonny Rollins, of course, one of the beacons of East Coast jazz, hard bop, but he was out playing a date in Los Angeles in 1957. I'm guessing now that he was between contracts. And he signed, presumably, a freelance contract.
I want to hear a little bit from Sonny Rollins. He recorded I've Told Every Little Star for the label, but is the label still in existence?
Only as a reissue outlet. No one is actively recording for Contemporary. However, Contemporary records are still being reissued thanks to Fantasy Records in Berkeley, California.
So this is a wonderful trip down memory lane. Let's hear Sonny Rollins. Also performs a version of I'm an Old Cow Hand on this compilation CD, and it's a song written by Johnny Mercer, and watch this segue.
Here we go.
He's the subject of a new biography that I see you have there.
I do indeed. It's called Portrait of Johnny, The Life of John Herndon Mercer, one of the foremost lyricists, although occasionally he wrote words and music, as in the case of I'm an Old Cow Hand, words and music by John Herndon Mercer. This is a biography by a gifted author, a man named Gene Lees. He was a personal friend of Johnny Mercer's.
Well, now, Johnny Mercer, as you say, songwriter, but also a singer.
This is true. He had a string of hits from the early 40s into the early 1950s. He was also one of the three founders of Capitol Records.
Well, let's hear Johnny Mercer singing one of his own tunes, One for My Baby and One More for the Road.
You'd never know it, but, buddy, I'm a kind of poet, and I've got a lot of things to say. And when I'm gloomy, you simply got to listen to me until it's talked away.
greatest saloon song ever written. Everyone knows Sinatra's version.
But this is his, and he wrote it. And he was quite, you know, quite a character in his day. I'm wondering, what's in the, you know, what do we learn about him in the biography?
Well, one thing we learn about him is that the great love of his life was Judy Garland, and in all likelihood, the song from which we just heard that excerpt, One for My Baby and One More for the Road, was written for Judy Garland.
Well, let's hear Judy Garland, as you said, the love of Johnny Mercer's life, singing his Come Rain or Come Shine.
Days may be cloudy or sunny. We're in or we're out of the money. But I'm with you, baby.
Well, I'm not going to listen to either of those songs the same way ever again, either One for My Baby, One More for the Road, or Judy Garland singing Come Rain or Come Shine, now that we know there's a backstory there.
There is indeed.
The relationship between her and Johnny Mercer.
But when you look at all of the fantastic songs he wrote, Johnny Mercer, by the way, was called the greatest lyricist in the English language, not only by Oscar Hammerstein II, but by Alan J. Lerner. I could, right now, without really thinking about it, I could name 30 songs that are just, you know, part of the American musical language and always will be.
Okay, and you can read about how they were written in the new biography. It's called Portrait of Johnny, The Life of John Herndon Mercer by Gene Lees. One last gift suggestion from James.
Well, Christmas time is here, Robin, and what do you know? That's the title of this new Diane Reeves Yuletide collection.
Diane Reeves, you have said she is the Sarah Vaughan of this generation.
Yeah, I guess that has some resonance, both for good and for not so good. Diane Reeves has a tremendous vocal instrument, as did Sarah Vaughan. At times, she is in the grand tradition of virtuoso show-offs. People who have such unbelievable technical prowess and sometimes overuse it. On this new album, though, the Christmas album, she is just a sublime interpreter of seasonal favorites, and she's got an excellent backing group with her. And I thought we'd hear a song that it's not overly done at Christmas or any other time of year. I'll Be Home for Christmas. Nice sentiment. Listen to how she gives it a little unusual twist, how she flats the notes. You'll hear Diane Reeves.
I'll be home. You can count on me. Please have snow and mistletoe and presents beneath the tree.
Cool samba treatment.
That's beautiful.
Diane Reeves, I'll Be Home for Christmas.
Well, James, thanks so much. You've helped with the shopping chores, as usual.
It is indeed my pleasure.
Here now is jazz aficionado James Isaacs. For more information on James' jazz picks, check out our website, here-now.org.
Hark, how the bells, sweet silver bells, all sing to say, throw cares away. Christmas is here, bringing good cheer to young and old, meek and the bold.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now.
One seems to hear words of good cheer from everywhere, filling the air. Oh, how they pound, raising that sound over hill and dale, telling a tale. Gaily they ring while people sing.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.